Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
The forward pass in American football is starting to take shape in 1911 with recent rules of revisions. We learned this in last edition of Football History Rerun Part 29. The new concept of the incomplete pass took a lot of risk out of throwing a forward pass, and tinkering and making the forward pass better tool for offenses was not complete, though, as the rules revisions of 1912 honed it once again, and we have this story and more coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And history just wouldn't be history if we didn't cover year by year through football. And we're doing that with a Football History Rewind. And we bring that next episode of the Football History Rewind here on Pigskin Dispatch's podcast. We're at episode number 30, covering the year of 1912. And what a big year 1912 was. And to fully appreciate the changes of the year 1912, we must first review the mechanics of how the forward pass worked within the rules just before the changes occurred. In a nutshell, 1911 and before, forward passes had to be thrown by an offensive player from 5 yards or more on his own side and behind the line of scrimmage. And the pass could travel no more than 20 yards, and there were sticks placed by the officiating crew 20 yards in advance of the line of scrimmage to help enforce this rule requirement. Should an offensive player catch a forward pass beyond his opponent's goal line, it was not a touchdown, but rather it was a touchback at this point in history. Remember, the goal lines were the end of the field. There was no end zone. The field itself was 110 yards long, goal line to goal line, and there were no end zones. The offense had 3 downs to reach a line to gain, and that was a 10 yards in advance of the ball's field position at the start of a new series. Officials placed an additional set of sticks to indicate this 10-yard zone before the snap of the first play in a new series. And please think of the word sticks in the literal sense of the word. They were most of the time just long pieces of rough-cut lumber and sometimes even tree branches. And many times, they tied a 10-yard rope to accurately measure, use accurately in quotes, measure the 10-yard zone. Protective player equipment was essentially non-existent by today's standards. The only player equipment really used was an occasional leather ear covers by some of the rudimentary nose protectors that we've shown you at some other episodes on Pigskin Dispatch. So just some crazy looking things, you know, sort of look like a jock strap hanging over a guy's face over the nose. We'll try to post another pic of that here real soon for you. Now, so that's what football was before these rule revisions. Kind of foreign to us, like it's, you know, playing a game on a different planet or something. Well, these changes in 1912 would evolve the game greatly with some broad base sweeping revisions to the rules by the Rules Committee, which was now formally known as the NCAA. I remember they renamed themselves back in 1910. And as the first changes would be to the playing field and the equipment of use. Well, the field itself would be changed greatly by adding 2 10-yard end zones and reducing the length of the playing field from 110 yards long goal line to goal line to 100 yards between the goals. Then you have those 2 10-yard end zones, so now it's 120. The uprights would still be situated on the goal lines, constituting the major difference between the field layout of 1912 and today. And, you know, our friend Timothy P. Brown, I highly recommend his book, How Football Became Football, the First 150 Years. And You know, Tim points out a very good point. You know, the reason that the field didn't stay 110 yards goal line to goal line and then add the end zones on, like the Canadian football did eventually, was because of a very important stadium, and that's Harvard Stadium up in Boston. They had built a concrete stadium because there was so much angst and problems with wooden stadiums. So Harvard got smart and they said, we're going to build a cement stadium. Well, if you would have lengthened the field by, you know, 10 more yards, it would not fit in Harvard's stadium. You know, Walter Camp on many occasions even wanted to make the field much wider for these sweeping changes so that players could run, have a little bit more room to run, and it would probably lessen the brutality of the game a little bit. Of course, you know, Harvard and some others decided to ixnay that because of, again, the stadium size. So remember that Tim Brown brings up a very important point, that that's why this field was restricted to the 53 yards wide, 120 total yards, end line to end line, 100 yards, goal line to goal line, those 10-yard end zones. So very important. The field equipment was slightly altered too, spurned by the rule revision. An abolishment of the restriction on passing beyond 20 yards was enacted, and thus the 20-yard sticks that we talked about just a few minutes ago were also removed from the face of football. And this had to bring much joy to the officials, who had to constantly move the 20-yard marker after every change in field position. The physical aspect of the game of moving the stick was probably not the most tedious task of the mechanic, but rather the 20-yard calculation, especially when the stick would be the opposite side of the midfield and was more time-consuming and brain-draining duty than anything. Now, the new rules also awarded a touchdown for a forward pass caught in these new end zones rather than the previous touchback ruling. You know, that's kind of another point that Tim Brown brings out. You know, when they were the end of the field and somebody caught it in the end zone, they were basically out of bounds. And that's why it resulted in a touchback. So now putting these end zones in there, part of the playing field, it's live ball, a receiver catches that pass, touchdown, just like we know it today. So very important thing to do there. And the new rules also awarded a touchdown for a forward pass caught in the end zones, and offenses would begin to embrace the pass more with changes such as these and be able to throw more than 20 yards downfield also. Now, scoring was once again altered, making a touchdown worth 6 points from the previous 5 points it was valued. So all the way since 1898 to 1911, it was 5 points. So first time in history a touchdown is worth 6 points. Now, that's very important due to the fact now it was worth more than a goal from the field, which was still valued at 4 points. Remember, early football, a field goal is worth more than a touchdown. And then they were the same for a while. Well, for the last few years leading up to this 1912 revision, you know, field goal was 4, touchdown was 5. Now it's a 2-point margin. A touchdown's 2 points better. Player personal safety saw some advancement too when Harvard's captain Percy Wendell developed a nose guard that was made of rubber and it sat in place by being gripped with the back teeth. The idea was not new, as similar contraptions were used in earlier years, but Wendell's innovation of holes for breathing through it made it become much more of a used piece of equipment. These devices were some of the earliest forms of mouth guard protection, even though it was not the primary function of the device, but merely an underappreciated safety feature way ahead of its time. And, you know, it was basically to protect the nose and, you know, clenching it with the teeth. But what they didn't realize what they were doing. There's a lot of damage done when you take a rocking shot and your teeth chatter together. That's what those mouth guards protect. Well, the game is truly shaping up to be what we think of it now in all respects to rule and field design. The strategy of the game, well, they were lagging, though, in comparison. But coaches were now getting a bit more comfortable with the new rules and new philosophies that were being developed across the country. That next edition, in part number 31, we'll shed some light on some of these and their importance to the transformation of the football game. But probably the largest impact of the game due to the 1912 rule revisions was the increase in downs in a series. Yeah, fourth down made its grand debut in football during the ensuing season, and once again, the basic offensive strategy of the sport evolved as well. Well, before we go, let's talk about the 1912 season, and we had a very impactful item that happened in professional football. Historian Chris Willis, author of some great books on Red Grange and Dutch Clark. He's got one going on Bronco Nagurski. It's going to be coming out soon. We've talked to him here, and we'll probably talk to him some more. Chris writes for the Pro Football Journal, our friends there, that in Canton, a man by the name of Jack Cusack took over as the Canton Athletic Club's secretary treasurer for no pay, and he did it as a favor he owed to Bulldogs captain Roscoe Oberlin. Well, the manager at the time, a fellow by the name of H.H. Halter, really didn't care much for Cusack, and the feeling must have been somewhat mutual. Remember, in our last episode, we relayed the story that Canton had lost in a forfeited game what was, in essence, the Ohio State title game to the Shelby Blues a season earlier. And knowing this, and the feeling was his team needed a little push to get it over the top. Well, Cusack went behind Halter's back and signed a contract with the Akron Indians representative, Peggy Perrott, for a couple of games to be scheduled in 1912 between the two clubs. Now, H.H. Halter had tried a couple of times to reach an agreement with Akron, but they just couldn't get to the conditions of the game to be agreeable. Halter must have been the sticking point, because Akron seemed pretty anxious and willing to sign with Peggy Perrott, and Cusack got together. Now, Halter, he was kind of miffed at it when he found out, so he tried to get rid of Jack Cusack, but it was found out that Cusack had secured a contract with Akron, and a five-year lease was reached with Canton to play at Lakeside Park. Well, the man that was getting the ouster was Halter, so the club Canton got rid of him. And Cusack, they didn't realize at the time, but what a great find they had, because Cusack took over as manager and added some college all-stars to the roster, as well as added over 1,500 new seats to the Lakeside Park that he just got the lease for. And the Bulldogs, for once since that horrific 1906 scandal with Massillon, finally were becoming profitable for the first time in years. Now, we wanted to duly note this event in 1912 because it'll come back to roost later in later episodes and later years of football. So we'll refer back to this. And no, Canton did not take the state of Ohio's crown in pro football in 1912. They were one of the many teams that vied for it. Shelby still had a good team. The Columbus Panhandles, Cincinnati Celts, they were a tough team. Toledo had a good squad. And Akron was still a very viable team. Well, but the team that surprised everybody was the Elyria Athletics Club, based in Elyria, Ohio. The Athletics surprised Perrott's Akron Indians with a 10-0 victory and to basically win the Ohio State Championship, and iced it with a 14-7 victory over Canton the following week to complete a perfect 8-0 record, and they are recognized as the mythical Ohio League's champion for 1912. And that was traditionally, for years, the top team of Ohio. Well, they ended up being the best pro football team. But in the college ranks, in 1912, champions were the Harvard University Crimson football team. The Harvard 11 finished with a record of 9-0 and were retroactively named as the national champion by the Helms Athletic Foundation, Billingsley Report, Holgate System, and Park H. Davis. And other considerations for the title were Wisconsin, who was 7-0 that season, and they outscored their opponents by a margin of 30-1. In games, so the outstanding team they had. And Penn State was also at a perfect 8-0, but it was felt that neither of those teams had as tough of a schedule as Harvard did, so they were retroactively given as the championship. Now, we'll be back next week with some more of the 1912 rules changes and how their impact on the game happened in part number 31 of the Football History Rewind, found here only on Pigskin Dispatch and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast. So until next week, everybody, enjoy that great football year-by-year history. But remember, we have a podcast each and every day. So we'll see you then. And until tomorrow, have a great gridiron day. Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. A special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, is found right here on the Sports History Network.